This week, Israel agrees to a daily four-hour pause for Palestinians to flee the danger and aid workers to provide support.
We're working very aggressively on getting more humanitarian assistance into Gaza, and we have very concrete ways of doing that. And I think you'll see in the days ahead that that assistance can expand in significant ways.
Giving peace a chance, what leaders say Gaza can and cannot look like when the war is over.
They are going to be living together no matter what, and we have to find a way for that to happen as justly and securely and decently as possible. And we've had a glimpse into the abyss. We've never had violence like this. And I think a lot of Israelis and Palestinians will come out on the other side and say, okay, what do we do to make days like these never return again?
And 1 year away from the next U.S. presidential election, we'll look at the global implications of a second Trump presidency. Join us on Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. Thousands of Palestinians are fleeing northern Gaza as Israel's military pushed deeper into dense urban neighborhoods in its battle with Hamas militants. The search for safety in Gaza is growing more desperate as combat intensifies.
We were sleeping. Babies, children, elderly people. I'm 54 years old. My brother is 67 years old. I'm not sure about their fate. We were sleeping. We're peaceful people. We have nothing to do with the so-called Israel, the enemies of humanity.
Palestinians sheltering at Shifa Hospital, the largest in Gaza, fled early Friday after Israel struck the courtyard and the obstetrics department where tens of thousands of people are sheltering. The White House announced Thursday Israel will implement four-hour daily pauses in its military operation against Hamas in areas of northern Gaza to allow civilians to safely get out of harm's way, as well as two humanitarian corridors. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that far too many Palestinians have died and more needs to be done to save lives and get aid where it's most needed.
All of this is a work in progress. Look, we know the deep concern here for the terrible toll that Gaza is taking on Palestinians, on men, women, and children in Gaza, innocent civilians, a concern that we share and that we're working on every single day.
And in Israel, families are still grieving the barbaric Hamas murders, and many continue to agonize over the fate of loved ones being held hostage by Hamas. Doris Lieber says her son is one of those hostages. She believes he was shot at the music festival on October 7th. Now, more than a month since they were taken, families are pleading with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to help.
Every day is like eternity to me, and I can't wait any longer because I know that he was shot. I don't know anything. Maybe everything is we don't know. We don't have a list of the hostages. We don't know their condition. I don't have anything.
And while the war is expected to continue, along with efforts to secure safe return of Hamas hostages, the U.S. is urging Israel to prepare for the aftermath of this war and what it will look like for the people in Gaza.
What we absolutely agree with our Israeli counterparts on is what it can't look like, and it can't look like it looked on October 6th.
And while a transition period will likely be needed, White House National Security spokesman John Kirby says neither Israel nor Hamas can control Gaza after the war.
President Biden's been very clear. We don't support a reoccupation of Gaza by the Israeli Defense Forces. We do think that there needs to be a healthy set of conversations about what post-conflict Gaza looks like and what governance looks like.
Israeli authorities are planning for the recovery of towns destroyed in the Hamas attack. But given the growing tensions with Israel's Arab neighbors, what are the prospects for peace? And has this conflict driven a deeper wedge that could make coexistence even farther out of reach? For a look at the challenges ahead, I spoke with John Linden, Executive Director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace.
John, you know, Israel was just on the cusp of a historic peace agreement with Saudi Arabia before Hamas brutally attacked. Many have noted that was intentional. Do you agree with that? And why would that fall apart now?
Well, it's difficult to know. Most military analysts seem to think that this attack took a long time to plan. Its level of sort of sophistication in the way in which the wall and sort of automated defense systems were breached, as well as the planning, maps were uncovered that showed a high degree of mapping of of Israeli military facilities and communications facilities. So it's possible that the Saudi normalization deal was a factor in perhaps accelerating it or the date that it took place. I think Hamas certainly had a reason to want to disrupt what they saw as sort of Israel's gradual integration into the wider Middle East. The other thing I think we should note is that it coincided with the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the Yom Kippur War, when, you know, many people saw a surprise Egyptian attack disrupting regional dynamics and a status quo that pre-existed. It is important to note that the ferocity and the barbarism of Hamas's attack is in a very different league entirely to conventional military operations. But it is clear they did want to try and accomplish something grisly but strategic. And amongst those goals, I assume, was disrupting normalization. And you can see on those terms, with the reaction of many of the Gulf state to anger within their own populations around the response, which was inevitable in some way, at the Gaza Strip, that Hamas have succeeded in the short term in delaying, certainly, Saudi normalization. Although it's interesting, they may have failed in many other respects, and one of them being, I still think regional integration is hopefully an inevitability in the region, and I think hopefully the growing acceptance of the different countries in the region to have normalized relations is a train that has left the station. But now I think it is increasingly unlikely that that can be done without some level of integration and addressing the Palestinian issue. Now, not on Hamas's terms, to be very clear, but some critics of the Abraham Accords had said that it was a way of bypassing the Palestinian issue. I had been somebody who said that there was a way to integrate it in and try and find a way to use these new dynamics to breathe life into a status quo that had been very stale. But I think now what we're seeing is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict will not go away. It has the ability to radically alter our geopolitical reality and create huge instability. And now maybe we can see relationships with Saudi, with the UAE, with Bahrain, with others being leveraged towards addressing that conflict.
It's also, it would seem that Hamas has an advantage in public opinion now because of Israel's response. Is that also sort of a catch-22 for Israel? Is it even possible to have peace between Israel and the Palestinians when now it would seem that a large part of the world is feeling compassion for what's happening to civilians in the Palestinian territory? And yet what happened in Israel was, as you said, grisly. It was horrific. It was, there are no words to describe it. And it's still happening, given that they're still holding over 200 hostages.
And thank you for raising that. It's a detail that has increasingly been forgotten by many people internationally, but there are civilian hostages being held in the Gaza Strip. Friends of mine are amongst them. And I think we need to make sure that international pressure and attention remains on trying to have those hostages released immediately. It's an overriding priority for all of us in the peace-building space. I think on your first point around the kind of reaction across the Arab world, it's sadly one of the predictable dynamics in this conflict. Ultimately, sort of an aspect of this that goes beyond simply judging an event on its own terms, but seeing what it's doing to your people. And much in the same way that the Jewish diaspora would react in a way that's different to other people, to violence visited upon Israelis, Arabs across the region will react in ways that are sometimes not the most obvious objective analysis to violence visited on Palestinians. I think what's important for us internationally, particularly those of us who are privileged not to be living in the nightmare we're seeing right now, is to try and take the longer view on this. I remember in the war in 2014, we saw that same predictable reaction across the region where people went to their corners, picked their sides. But in the aftermath, and I remember this, I visited Gaza very soon afterwards, there was deep reflection amongst Palestinians on the actions that Hamas had taken. And there was reflection amongst Israelis on the actions their government had taken, which really affected an election that took place a year later. So, you know, there's the immediate human visceral reaction to violence that plays upon your own identity. And then hopefully after a ceasefire, and we do need at some point to see this end, there may be an opportunity for a more reflective conversation, primarily amongst Israelis and Palestinians. It's very, very important that people reckon with what has happened and ways to stop it happening again, but also in the wider region. And I think we might be able to see that on a government-to-government level, I'm pretty confident, but potentially even with Palestinians.
We're hearing stories of all the hospitals are either demolished or unable to function. You've got the visuals, obviously, that Hamas wants you to see of children wounded, dead. That is also a reality. Have we ever seen Israel take such a strong response to where they're literally just plowing over so much of Gaza?
No, I mean, everything, I know it's a cliche, this moment is entirely unprecedented. We have never seen violence such as that which was visited on Israeli civilians on October 7th, and we've never seen as devastating a military operation on the Gaza Strip. To put it into context, more Israelis died on the single day of October 7th than died in the Second Intifada. And as of today, three times as many Palestinians have died in the Gaza Strip as died in the entire Second Intifada, a five-year period, which had been up until now the most devastating violence either side had ever seen. On the human level, regardless of your politics, I mean, as I mentioned, I have Israeli friends who are currently being held hostage in Gaza, people whose homes are destroyed in kibbutzim. And I have a Palestinian colleague on our team whose in-laws and friends, he grew up in Gaza, their houses have been blown up in airstrikes, innocent civilians, a relative of his who had to give birth in a hospital that is devastated right now in recent weeks. Today, I was working with another member of AllMap. We were trying to get her family out of the Gaza Strip. They're living in terror in Gaza City, which is encircled. And I think everybody, again, particularly with the privilege of not living in this nightmare, needs to really reflect on the toll this is taking on civilians and on the prioritization of civilian life, Israeli life and Palestinian life.
Bearing in mind that Israel says it's going to destroy Hamas, are the Palestinian leaders able and incentivized to try to take control?
It's a key question. So right now, we've also seen exploding violence in the West Bank, where the more moderate Palestinian Authority and Fatah party are in charge, where we've also seen loss of life on a level that's unprecedented since the Second Intifada, in what is already the most violent year in the West Bank since the Second Intifada. So the PA is working to try and maintain stability in the West Bank, you know, with issues around settler violence, as well as militias that have grown up in the West Bank over the last year. I mean, that is the number one priority, because if things further escalate in the West Bank in tandem with what we're seeing in Gaza, then we could see devastation on a level that truly we haven't seen since 1948. It's an overriding concern, and the Biden administration, I think, on the West Bank piece has been very clear and firm on the need for prioritization of that issue. The other part around the PA and sort of moderate Palestinian leaders being able to carve a path, it's very complicated. There are forces within the Israeli government, ministers who are ideologically opposed to the Palestinian Authority preceding this escalation and Hamas's terrible violence. So it isn't as simple as investing in the Palestinian Authority, themselves being a very imperfect institution, it must be said. But in contrast with Hamas, I think it's pretty clear which entity you would prefer to be governing the lives of Palestinians. And I think what's really needed for the PA is, number one, we need to see fresh leadership and ideas. Ultimately, Hamas may be militarily defeated in Gaza, although that is yet to be seen. But ultimately, the ideology and the vision that they represent, that must be defeated as well. You defeat that by an alternative being invested in. And there's a responsibility for Palestinian leaders to present that alternative. I think it will probably have to wait until after the ceasefire. But there's also a huge responsibility for us internationally. We have to provide young Palestinians, and people forget how young this society is compared to ours, with an alternative based on non-violence, but also with the goal of self-determination and freedom and an end to military occupation. These are things that have been swept aside in recent years under this idea that the conflict could be managed. And that presents real dilemmas for moderate Palestinian leaders. That's a very hard reality to sell to frustrated Palestinians. If we internationally can instead carve out a real diplomatic horizon that can deliver security for Israelis, real security, and self-determination and freedom for Palestinians, I still believe that that will defeat Hamas and the ideology they represent in the marketplace of ideas. But we have to provide it. If what we leave after this is a return to the status quo ante, or the kind of devastating violence and dehumanization we've seen in recent weeks, I do worry that Hamas will be able to claim some sort of victory amongst at least partial aspects of Palestinian society. So for everybody's interest, we need to see that diplomatic process commence. And the level of attention and centrality by prime ministers and presidents and foreign ministers in recent weeks around the initial explosion of violence, that needs to be sustained for the messier, more long-term process of a diplomatic agreement. If it recedes in the immediate aftermath of the ceasefire, we internationally will own a share of responsibility for anything that comes afterwards. This is also on us in the international community.
Well, you mentioned world leaders, prime ministers, presidents. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's expansion of Jewish settlements in the West Bank certainly was not helpful in any sort of peace agreement, but we also haven't really heard from him and his administration any sort of desire for that in the past few years.
I think that's true. I think it's important. You know, I don't want to make this party political, but Prime Minister Netanyahu had campaigned on and governed and convinced many Israelis of this idea of conflict management, that essentially the Palestinian cause was receding from the international agenda, that yes, there may be periodic bouts of rocket fire, but ultimately Hamas was contained, and that the settlement project on the West Bank could continue apace toward a goal, really, of annexation, which Prime Minister Netanyahu tried to pursue only 3 years ago. All of that has been shown to be a failure on Israeli self-interested national security terms. Forget about what the international community or Palestinians might want. And I think it's important to reflect also on the security dimension. We saw on October 7th, it's rumored that there was two battalions of the Israeli Defense Forces in the south protecting the residents of the kibbutzim in the south of the country, whilst it's rumored there was 26 battalions in the West Bank who were protecting settlers, including in places like Hebron, where you have, you know, somewhere like 600 or 700 settlers living in the center of a city protected by 2,500 soldiers. This is not sustainable. And Israel can see now, particularly with the worrying escalation on the northern border, that choices need to be made. Israeli security and the protection of Israeli civilian life should not be at the mercy of an ideological project in the West Bank, which undermines that security and also which creates dynamics of violence and injustice for Palestinians, which also, in addition to the way they hurt Palestinian lives and livelihood, they create further resentment, anger and violence. I hope and believe that after this war, there'll be a chance to have that conversation in Israel in a way that we haven't seen for decades. But I also think even if all those things happen, we have two societies so deeply traumatized by what they've seen and experienced in recent weeks. And, you know, in addition to this diplomatic horizon that I said, we need a project to rehumanize and repair those relations, to really try and create Israeli-Palestinian trust, because we can criticize leaders on both sides, but ultimately they're a function of the societies they sit on top of. And we have to create, over time, incentives in those societies for partnership, for cooperation, for Israeli-Palestinian shared institution building. This might sound very naive in this moment, but we have precedents for where we've seen it work in other conflict zones. There's nothing different about Israelis and Palestinians to people in Northern Ireland or the Balkans or South Africa. And I think the world also, in addition to a diplomatic process, should embark upon a big, ambitious plan for rehabilitating these societies and creating the trust and relationships that ultimately will be a bridge towards peace, but also provide security and a force field against the kind of dehumanization you need to have.
Is it possible to have peace?
It's not only possible, there is no alternative. Everyone is being exhausted, but ultimately it's a question of how much blood is going to be shed. Israelis and Palestinians will share this land. The proportion of the population is 50-50 between the Jordan and the Mediterranean. 20% of Israelis are Palestinian Arabs. 35% of Jerusalemites are Palestinians. They are going to be living together no matter what, and we have to find a way for that to happen as justly and securely and decently as possible. And we've had a glimpse into the abyss. We're still glimpsing into it right now. We've never had violence like this. And I think a lot of Israelis and Palestinians will come out on the other side and say, okay, what do we do to make days like these never return again? There's something called the Belfast moment, where Irish people became so exhausted by conflict that they finally started looking at alternatives for it. This violence is so much worse than anything we saw in Northern Ireland over decades. And maybe with international support and help and those civil society movements I spoke about, enough Israelis and Palestinians will look at each other and say, okay, let's figure out a way to share this land.
John Linden, Executive Director of the Alliance for Middle East, thank you so much.
Thank you, Laurie.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Laurie London. Five Republican presidential candidates faced off at a debate Wednesday night, sparring over foreign policy, abortion rights, and Donald Trump, the party's front runner who did not participate. Associated Press correspondent Jennifer King has an update.
At a debate in Miami, five Republican presidential candidates all say they support Israel, but they squabbled over China and Ukraine.
Then we will go and end all formal trade relations with China until they stop murdering Americans from fentanyl, something Ron has yet to say that he's going to do.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis squared off with Nikki Haley.
She welcomed them into South Carolina, gave them land near a military base.
Frontrunner Donald Trump, who skipped the debate and attended a rally instead, drew fire from former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie.
Anybody who's going to be spending the next year and a half of their life focusing on keeping themselves out of jail and courtrooms cannot leave this party or this country.
Debate audio courtesy NBC News. I'm Jennifer King.
While his opponents debated, Trump held a rally in Florida aiming to gain support from its large Cuban community and taking swipes at President Biden.
Crooked Joe Biden and the radical left Democrats are turning the United States into communist Cuba, and you know, because we have a lot of great Cubans here.
And Biden has continued to challenge assertions being made by his likely opponent.
Donald Trump often says, we're now, quote, we're now a failing nation. We're a nation in decline. But that's not what I see.
But with the 2024 U.S. presidential election just 1 year away, Democrats are alarmed by recent polls showing Biden trailing Trump in five of the six most important battleground states. So what would a second Trump presidency look like? For insights, I spoke with Claire Finkelstein, faculty director at the University of Pennsylvania's Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. What do you see as the implications for the United States and for its allies? How would that look?
Let's start with the global situation, because that is so much top of mind these days. And think about how Donald Trump would be handling the kind of crisis that we are dealing with right this very minute. in Israel and Gaza, as well as in Ukraine. Foreign affairs are very often a distraction. Wars are often a convenient distraction for world leaders that are in a domestic crisis. And so I would very much fear Donald Trump's leadership for the United States in handling such a delicate crisis as we have today in the Middle East. When you look at President Biden's handling of this situation, which has been careful and nuanced, supporting Israel yet insisting that Israel remain within the bounds of international law, working with world leaders, talking to Egypt to try to get the Rafah gate open. All of that requires such careful, nuanced diplomacy. However, out of control the situation already is in the Middle East, I fear what it would become were Donald Trump to be crashing about in that situation.
President Biden has repeatedly talked about foreign aid and our own national security, our standing in the world to support democracies. Would that likely be something that would stall out as well, foreign aid? And what implications would that have if it did?
It very likely would. So we know that Donald Trump held up aid to Ukraine that Congress had voted on. That was the basis for the first impeachment. While he claimed during his presidency to be a great friend of Israel, there was also the concern that, in fact, one of the advantages that Hamas had going into the October 7th attack was that they may have gotten classified information passed to them via Iran that may originally have been leaked by Donald Trump in 2017. Now, those accusations have not been substantiated, but there has been considerable amount of speculation of reporting to that effect. So we don't know whether or not Donald Trump would stand by Israel. And we certainly have every reason to think that he would not be standing by Ukraine, because that is directly crossing the interests of the Russian Federation, and he has shown himself to be a great friend of Putin's and carrying Putin's water. So I do think that we would see some very significant changes in the way that the U.S. is situated relative to these two gigantic generation-shaping transnational conflicts.
The Biden administration has made addressing climate change on the world stage that it was back in the game as far as its participation in fighting climate change. We're coming up on another climate conference at the end of this month. How would the U.S. approach to climate potentially change in a second term of Donald Trump?
Well, we know that the Trump administration in the first go round was very much opposed to climate measures to try to get the climate change problem under control. The administration was in favor of, for example, increased drilling and fracking and very controversial measures pulled out of the climate accord and so on. So we know that where Trump stands, if he focuses on the issue at all, or where in any event the people that he would likely bring on would stand. And so I don't expect that we would continue to make any progress on the climate front, and indeed that we would be going backwards on the climate front. That would be a grave concern. There is a desire to have the United States be a little bit less dependent on foreign sources of oil and gas across the board, and Republicans usually favor that, but of course that is not advantageous to Russia's interests. It very much, you know, up in the air in a second Trump administration, what would happen to U.S. dependence, former U.S. dependence on Russian oil and gas, since the U.S., with the sanctions in place, pulled out of all of those commercial relations. The Trump administration was, of course, great friends with the Saudis, and that's something where there might be a dovetailing of interests, since Biden did start to reapproach the Saudis in an effort to get away from Russian energy sources. So how Saudi Arabia relates to all this, Venezuela is another question, which Biden very controversially as well even approached again, trying to get away from Russian oil and gas sources. I think this is an extremely complex set of relations that is very hard to predict how it would come out.
Claire Finkelstein, faculty director at the University of Pennsylvania's Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, we thank you very much for listening. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.